Welcome to an excerpt of the CME activity, Individualizing Treatment Targets and Choice of Medication in Type 2 Diabetes, Endocrine-Based Therapies, which is certified by Medscape and presented by Julio Rosenstock, MD, Silvio E. Inzuki, MD, and Robert E. Ratner, MD. Dr. Rosenstock is a director, Dallas Diabetes and Endocrine Center at Medical City, clinical professor of medicine, University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center at Dallas, Dallas, Texas. Dr. Rosenstock has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. He received grants for clinical research from Amylin Pharmaceuticals, AstraZeneca Pharmaceuticals, Boehringer Ingelheim Pharmaceuticals, Bristol-Myers Squibb Company, Daiichi Sankyo, Eli Lilly and Company, Forest Laboratories, GlaxoSmithKline, Johnson & Johnson Pharmaceutical Research and Development, Mankind Corporation, Merck & Company, Novartis Pharmaceuticals Corporation, Novo Nordisk, Pfizer, Roche, Sanofi Aventis, and Takeda Pharmaceuticals North America. He served as an advisor or consultant for Amylin Pharmaceuticals, Boehringer Ingelheim Pharmaceuticals, Centocor, Daiichi Sankyo, Eli Lilly and Company, GlaxoSmithKline, Johnson & Johnson Pharmaceutical Research and Development, Lexicon Pharmaceuticals, Mankind Corporation, Novartis Pharmaceuticals Corporation, Novo Nordisk, Pfizer, Roche, Sanofi Aventis, and Takeda Pharmaceuticals North America. Dr. Rosenstock does intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Rosenstock does intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Inzuki is a professor of medicine, clinical director, endocrinology, Yale University School of Medicine, director, Yale Diabetes Center, Yale New Haven Hospital, New Haven, Connecticut. Dr. Inzuki has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. He served as an advisor or consultant for Merck & Company, Takeda Pharmaceuticals North America, Boehringer Ingelheim Pharmaceuticals, and Medtronic. He served as a speaker or a member of a speaker's bureau for Novo Nordisk. He received grants for clinical research from Eli Lilly and Company. Dr. Inzuki does not intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Inzuki does not intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Ratner is a professor of medicine, Division of Endocrinology and Metabolism, Georgetown University School of Medicine, Washington, D.C., senior scientist, MedStar Health Research Institute, Hyattsville, Maryland. Dr. Ratner has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. He received grants for clinical research from Bayhill Therapeutics, GlaxoSmithKline, Halozyme Therapeutics, Integrium, Sanofi Aventis, Shionogi, and Verilite. He served as an advisor or consultant for Amylin Pharmaceuticals, AstraZeneca Pharmaceuticals, Novo Nordisk, and Sanofi Aventis. He owns stock, stock options, or bonds from Merck & Company, Johnson & Johnson Pharmaceutical Research and Development, and Abbott Laboratories. Dr. Ratner does intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Ratner does intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. The purpose of this activity is to discuss the burden of type 2 diabetes and the rationale for individualization of diabetes care, and to provide clinical context on new data presented during the 47th European Association for the Study of Diabetes annual meeting, which was held September 12th through 16th, 2011 in Lisbon, Portugal, on emerging therapies for type 2 diabetes. This activity is supported by Sanofi. To participate in the CME activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title.
Hi, I'm Dr. Julio Rosenstock, Director of the Dallas Diabetes and Endocrine Center at Medical City and Clinical Professor of Medicine at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center in Dallas. I'd like to welcome you to this roundtable discussion. I'm here in Lisbon, Portugal, at the 47th annual meeting of the ESD, and I'm honored to be joined by two of my good friends and close colleagues and well-renowned experts in diabetes. I'd like to first introduce Dr. Silvio Inzucchi, Professor of Medicine at Yale University School of Medicine and Clinical Director of the Section of Endocrinology at Yale New Haven Hospital in Connecticut. Welcome to today's program, Silvio.
Thank you very much, Silvio.
I'm also very pleased to introduce Dr. Robert Ratner, whom I've known for many years, and he's a professor of medicine at Georgetown University School of Medicine in Washington, D.C., and a senior scientist at MedStar Health Research Institute in Maryland. Thank you for joining us today, Bob.
My pleasure, Julio.
The goal of today's discussion is to evaluate the burden of type 2 diabetes and the role of individualizing type 2 diabetes care with newer treatment strategies and agents. I'd also like to note that this discussion will include investigational agents not yet approved by regulatory agencies. Also, it is important to emphasize that we'll be discussing studies published as abstracts. This data should be considered preliminary until they are published in a peer-reviewed journal. So to begin our discussion, I'd like to ask our first interactive polling question. We would like to know, what is the average A1C level in your patients with type 2 diabetes before combination therapy is considered? Please click on your answer and see how your peers have responded. So let's begin first, and I want to begin with Silvio. Would you like to start our discussing, Silvio, by summarizing the burden of type 2 diabetes, and why is it that we may need to change our treatment paradigm?
Well, Julio, this week we have some new information in this regard from the International Diabetes Federation. And the new information that was presented this week was that there are 366 million people with diabetes worldwide. Now, obviously, most of that is type 2 diabetes, at least 90, if not 95%. That's 1 in 20 individuals worldwide. Interestingly, 4 out of 5 patients that are newly diagnosed these days are in developing countries. And this is now responsible for $465 billion in healthcare costs. It's also responsible, more importantly, for more than 4 million deaths per year. And for those of you that like to figure these statistics, that's one death per every 7 seconds. So the disease burden just globally, not just in the United States, is huge. And at an individual level, we're dealing with declining beta cell function, which compels the need for more and aggressive therapies. The adverse effects of the drugs themselves need to be considered in terms of the disease burden. And of course, the progressive complications, both micro and macrovascular.
So all those are things, not just the numbers, all the issues of the complications, and then how we treat it. But before we go into more details, why is it that growing so much?
Well, there are many explanations. Clearly, the associated risk factor for diabetes is obesity, and we know that obesity is increasing throughout the world. Now, importantly, obesity in and of itself is not solely responsible for the diabetes, and the reason for that is that there are many patients with obesity that never develop diabetes. So there really has to be a second issue, and that's the decline in beta cell function. And the decline in beta cell function continues even after the diagnosis of diabetes. And as mentioned, that's one of the reasons that more complex therapies are needed as we get further along in the disease course. Now, you asked about treatment paradigms and how they should be shifting. And I think that all of us realize that while we've been doing a reasonable job in managing diabetes over the past few decades, we need to do better. There's a call for what's known as minimally disruptive therapy, which I think is a great terminology. I mean, our patients are busy people. They have other conditions, sometimes other comorbidities, busy lives. And I think the more we can treat them with drugs without side effects that encumber their lives, the better they will be and the better we can be.
And treat them early.
Treating them early is important before the development of beta cell, of severe beta cell dysfunction. So we need safer, better tolerated medications. There's this notion of individualization of therapy, which I think is key, and I hope we can address this later on.
We'll come back to that point, which is that is a very critical one.
And then another controversial issue is whether we should be combining therapies at the outset as opposed to our current paradigm, which is essentially sequential therapy, treating to an A1C target. When that drug fails, to add another drug. And I'm not sure that's the most successful or more efficient way to treat this disease.
And probably not. If we assume that type 2 diabetes is heterogeneous with multiple defects, it doesn't really make that much sense to treat it with only one drug that only tackles one defect.
Right.
Yeah. Well, that's very interesting. Then, so what do you think about what Sylvia said, Bob?
I basically completely agree. The issues of really trying to get therapies that are fashioned to meet the needs of our patients and the needs of their pathophysiology, which, as you mentioned, is quite heterogeneous. It's logical that one person would respond to one particular therapy, another person may require a different therapy, even though they have the same glucose levels. So that level of individualization, I think, is absolutely critical.
And that you bring a very important point, and obviously we have no time to address all the armamentarium that we have with drugs in type 2 diabetes. But one thing that is a growing field and a growing space is the field of the GLP-1 related therapies. So would you like to comment about what is the role of GLP-1 in type 2 diabetes, and give us a little overview of GLP-1 related therapies or incretin related therapies?
Sure. Although the incretin field is a relatively new one therapeutically, our understanding of what's really going on there goes back 40 years. We know that there's a differential insulin response to a calorie load, a glucose load that's taken by mouth, as compared to an equivalent degree that's taken parenterally. And the differential insulin response is really the body's mechanism by which it augments insulin secretion and decreases glucagon secretion in response to an oral food challenge. So that when we begin to eat, even before the food gets down into the intestine, neurocircuits actually stimulate the release of two specific incretin hormones from the lower gut, GLP-1 and GIP. It turns out that GLP-1 probably has the most effect in terms of the pathophysiology of type 2 diabetes. But both of these hormones are released in response to a calorie load and have effects to try and augment metabolism in the postprandial state. So the GLP-1 in particular will stimulate glucose-mediated insulin secretion. So not independent of glucose, but along with glucose, what you'll see is a rise in postprandial insulin levels. Simultaneously, it will work on the alpha cells to suppress glucagon. Now, we know in type 2 diabetes that you tend to have a paradoxical increase in glucagon levels, and that increases endogenous glucose production. Clearly, postprandially, you don't need that source of glucose. So the appropriate suppression of glucagon becomes very important. Now, from the standpoint of enhancing the biological activities of these incretins, we're limited because native GLP-1 has a very, very short half-life. It's metabolized in 1 to 2 minutes. So there are two therapeutic approaches that can be taken. The first would be to decrease the metabolism of endogenous GLP-1 by inhibiting the enzyme that breaks it down, which is DPP-4. Alternatively, you can give exogenous GLP-1 in pharmacologic levels. The difficulty there is you have to have a formulation that is resistant to DPP-4 degradation. And so that's the direction that therapeutics have really been going in.
And those are the two categories of drugs that we have. One, the oral agents that are DPP-4 inhibitors, and these injectables that are GLP-1 receptor agonists. Work on the GLP-1 receptor by different mechanisms whereby they prolong the half-life. And what are those drugs?
Well, we have a whole variety of available drugs now, both in Europe and in the United States. In the United States, the first GLP-1 receptor agonist that was FDA approved was exenatide, a short-acting polypeptide that requires 2 injections per day. And that was the first that came on the market. Subsequently, we've had the introduction of liraglutide, which is a longer-acting formulation that's a once-a-day injectable. In Europe, they now have a once-weekly injectable formulation of exenatide.
Just recently approved
and now available. And in the U.S., it's currently before the Food and Drug Administration for final consideration.
And the DPP-4 inhibitors?
The DPP-4 inhibitors, the first one that was approved worldwide was vildagliptin in Europe, which has never come to the United States. The first approved agent in the U.S. was sitagliptin. We've subsequently had the addition of saxagliptin and most recently the addition of linagliptin.
So we have quite a bit of these drugs available, and we're going to talk about the efficacy in a minute. What are the key issues in terms of the safety that is so important these days?
Well, one needs to sit back and take a look at how these agents work. And the DPP-4 inhibitors are small molecules taken by mouth that simply boost endogenous GLP-1 levels. So the side effect profile of the DPP-4 inhibitors is actually quite good. Now, the difficulty with the DPP-4 inhibitors is that DPP-4 metabolizes a great many different hormones in the blood. So specificity becomes critically important to make sure that you're limiting the inhibition of degradation as tightly as you possibly can, so that some of the side effects may in fact be due to the non-specificity of the inhibitory effects on DPP-4. GLP-1 receptor agonists are given pharmacologically, and they tend to have more side effects than the DPP-4 inhibitors, the most common side effect being GI upset. One of the mechanisms by which GLP-1 actually works acutely is to slow gastric emptying, so that as an individual is eating, they get full more rapidly. Now, we would hope that our patients would understand that signal and stop eating. Unfortunately, many of them eat independent of hunger, and those satiety signals are ignored. When that happens, then nausea and, in fact, vomiting can also occur.
But still there is nausea, even if they control what they eat. There is an intrinsic effect of nausea, and it's an intrinsic effect of vomiting, and that is also centrally mediated and also related to the gastric emptying phenomenon.
Probably so, and it looks to be...
Most likely so.
And it looks to be dose-related, which is the real reason why when initiating a GLP-1 receptor agonist, you begin at a lower dose and titrate it up as tolerated.
But that's an important thing for people to recognize. Some people do get the nausea and vomiting. And for my understanding, is the average nausea in most of the trials is around 20 to 30% in general, 25%, vomiting anywhere from 9 to 10% and so on. So it's not for everybody. Those people probably not going to do well, although eventually some of those things
subside. Yeah, I think that's the critical issue, Julio, that it appears as though much of the nausea and virtually all of the vomiting is related to the peak concentration of the GLP-1, so that if you're getting a very high peak, that frequently causes the problem. And as we're beginning to move into some of the longer-acting GLP-1 agonists, what we're seeing is attenuation of those symptoms because we're not getting the peak-to-trough changes in GLP-1 levels.
And any other safety concerns?
There are some other safety concerns that have come out since the development program, two in particular. The first was identified well into the early preclinical stage, where GLP-1 receptors in the thyroid in rodents would bind the GLP-1, and what was observed in the rodent models was hyperplasia of the C cells. So concerns about medullary carcinoma of the thyroid arose. It turns out that GLP-1 receptors are not present on human thyroid. So although we've seen no evidence of medullary CA, currently the FDA limits the use of liraglutide in anyone with a personal history of medullary carcinoma of the thyroid or an MEN or anyone who has a family history of that disorder. That makes common sense.
Sure, it makes common sense. But this is basically limited for liraglutide.
For liraglutide. The second concern really has come out after the clinical trials with all of the GLP-1 and DPP-4 inhibitors, and that's the issue of pancreatitis. Now, it's clear that individuals with type 2 diabetes have an increased incidence of pancreatitis. But on retrospect, when we look at the clinical trial programs, there does seem to be an imbalance in the pancreatitis in those treated with the GLP-1 receptor agonists. There have been a lot of different analyses trying to understand this, but I think what we really need to do is to wait for the long-term cardiovascular outcome trials where we will clearly be able to see if there's a signal for pancreatitis.
Sure, we'll have more statistical power to see any differences. But the signal is there, and I think that is perfectly sensed with in the face of nausea and vomiting to detect that whether or not this person is of pancreatitis and recognize that for the practicing physician.
Absolutely. Important. I think that what becomes very important is that when a patient who's initiated on GLP-1 receptor agonist or a DPP-4 inhibitor complains of persistent abdominal pain, nausea, and vomiting, the practitioner has to take that seriously and has to discontinue the drug and evaluate the
And it's good that you point out DPP-4 inhibitors because the signal has been in subsequent reports that it appears to be also a little bit of a signal with the DPP-4 inhibitors.
Correct.
And so that's one of the issues. When we assume that a drug is safe, we don't pay much attention, but that's what I'm saying. Over time, we'll see, like what you mentioned about the DPP-4 inhibitors, we need to still remain open in terms of what things could happen in the future.
And also, anybody with a history in the past of pancreatitis should probably not be taking these medications as well.
Yeah, that's a good point. So, and you mentioned about the drugs that actually approved already in the clinical arena, GLP-1 receptor agonists and DPP-4 inhibitors. The truth is that there are several others in development. We have this exenatide twice a day, exenatide weekly. We have liraglutide. Those are approved. By the way, the exenatide weekly is only approved in Europe. But there is another long-acting GLP-1, which is dulaglutide. There's albiglutide, both of them once a week. And there's also lixisenatide that is once a week. And also,
lixisenatide is once a day.
Oh, thank you very much. Thank you. Once a day, yeah. See, that's good, Bob. That's why you're being invited to this meeting. Yeah. So we have several there agents to choose. And what is going to be interesting is the decision-making process, how we're going to be choosing between all the different agents. But that's specific in terms of therapies. One critical point is not just the decision-making process for selecting therapies, it's also the decision-making process to select how far we're going to treat, what kind of glycemic targets we're going to have. You know, different organizations, different national guidelines say A1C is less than 6.5, less than 7%. But the same way that we need to individualize therapies, we need to individualize targets. And Silvio, you've written a very good paper with your colleagues where you analyze the need to individualize targets, especially in the light of the recent outcome cardiovascular trials, and try to decide whether or not this individual is good for an A1C of 7 or 6.5 or 7.5, which is very important for practicing physicians. Could you expand on that,
sure,
please?
And this all stems from the large cardiovascular studies in part. Now, you know, we've, as clinicians, we've always known this. I mean, none of us were super aggressive in our 85-year-old patients with cardiovascular disease, but I think that we've become a bit more careful about approaching these treatment targets over the past 2 to 3 years since the data from the large studies, ACCORD, ADVANCE, and VADT came out. And clearly what we feel is that not only is it the cardiovascular risk factors in patients that should drive the target choice, but lots of other clinical characteristics, patient age, the duration of disease, since that is very often linked to the presence of vascular complications. Importantly, the risk of hypoglycemia is key because patients who have hypoglycemia unawareness really can't achieve the types of glucose targets that we would in other patients. Comorbidities, patients with limited life expectancies, of course. And the important point we tried to make in this paper is that all of these clinical characteristics need to be placed in what we call the psychosocial economic context of that patient. So we describe these. So for instance, in terms of the risk of hypoglycemia, we mentioned the development of hypoglycemia unawareness, or just the frequency of these episodes. Comorbidities, patients who are healthier are certainly more apt to have a longer life duration, and therefore achieving more stricter glucose targets makes a whole lot of sense. The psychosocial aspect, you know, there are some patients that are really non-compliant and don't do glucose monitoring. It's very difficult to achieve tight glycemic controls in those patients. So this is a complicated decision, and just having a strict A1C target for all patients really makes no sense. I know that the American Diabetes Association still endorses a general target of a hemoglobin A1C of less than 7%. But importantly, we need to individualize not only our drug choices, but how aggressive we want to be in terms of lowering their overall glucose levels.
But going back to the DPP-4 aspect, we're in Lisbon, we're at the ESD, and there's a lot of different studies that were presented with DPP-4. And Silvio, I'd like you to concentrate maybe in two studies that presumably you've seen that I draw my attention. One is, like this one was a head-to-head, you know, we need head-to-head studies. And obviously DPP-4 is an oral agent, so let's compare it to another oral agent, like a sulfonylurea. And then there's also the concept of the potential for DPP-4s to have some cardiovascular impact. And there's a couple of interesting studies that were presented in this meeting.
There are dozens of abstracts and poster presentations this week dealing with the DPP-4. There's lots of interest in this generally well-tolerated group of medications. So one that comes to mind is by Allen and Berglund, who looked at an important clinical scenario. What do you do after metformin? So these would be patients who are treated with metformin but need add-on therapy, combination therapy after metformin. So they looked at 850 patients, and they were randomized to adding saxagliptin, which is a newer DPP-4 inhibitor, versus glipizide, which is a traditional sulfonylurea. And the A1C reductions were very similar in both groups, less weight gain in the saxagliptin group. But the important take-home message is the hypoglycemia rate. So with saxagliptin, as you might expect, based on what Bob just told us, the hypoglycemia rate was only 3.5% over the treatment period, whereas in the glipizide group, it was more than tenfold. It was 38.4%. So I think this tells us that while we can achieve, at least at these levels of hemoglobin A1C, reasonable glycemic control with both sulfonylureas or DPP-4 inhibitor, there may be a safety advantage in terms of less hypoglycemia with the latter. There's a second abstract by Patel and colleagues. This looked at a even newer DPP-4 inhibitor known as linagliptin. So they compiled three studies, a linagliptin monotherapy study, an add-on to metformin, and then an add-on to metformin plus a sulfonylurea. They had over 2,200 patients. The A1C reductions in all these studies were what you see with DPP-4 inhibitors, which is about 0.6, 0.7%. But the interesting aspect of this study is that they stratified patients based on baseline characteristics. So they looked at age, diabetes duration, body mass index, and HOMA, which is a reflection of how insulin resistant a patient is. And it was interesting to note that in all the quartiles or tertiles of these characteristics, the linagliptin response was equivalent. So this drug appears to work equivalently, irrespective of age, disease duration, body weight, and degree of insulin resistance.
Yeah, this drug is the one that has been recently approved, linagliptin, yeah. Right? It's the one that is given once a day, and you don't need those adjustments, and you can be given in people with renal impairment.
That's right. A third study that you alluded to, and I'll just mention it quickly, was a meta-analysis involving, I believe it was 23,000 patients who've been exposed in clinical trials to DPP-4 inhibitors. So these are a variety of different products. And the question was, what happened to so-called major adverse cardiovascular events, or MACE events? And while this is highly preliminary and meta-analyses are fraught with some interpretive challenges, the odds ratio, when you compiled all these studies, was in the range of 0.7, so almost a 30% risk reduction in terms of these MACE events. Now, of course, we can't prescribe these agents hoping for cardiovascular benefit. There's a number of large cardiovascular studies being conducted with these agents, and we should know in a few short years. But it was interesting to see that abstract.
And it's very interesting and very suggestive because, as you mentioned, now any drug that needs to be approved has to go for the regulatory process of showing cardiovascular safety first and ideally cardiovascular protection. What is interesting in those DPP-4 inhibitors, saxagliptin, when was approved, actually was the first one that passed that hurdle and did a meta-analysis, a retrospective meta-analysis, and showed that there was cardiovascular safe, the hazard ratio was below one, quite below one. Linagliptin, that was just recently approved, also had a prospective meta-analysis and showed that the hazard ratio was below one. It was pretty low, like 0.4%. So it is very suggestive that all these DPP-4 are to the left. But to be fair, very limited.
The numbers of events are too low.
Correct.
To make those judgments.
Correct. It is,
and it's the long-term
absolutely.
Trials.
Absolutely. That's why
they
are sold thousands of patients now in the trials. But it's interesting that despite that, there's a trend there that is highly suggestive.
But let me add that, to make a conclusion about cardiovascular events, there should also be biological plausibility.
Sure.
And that still eludes me. I'm not sure about you guys, but these drugs are not known to be specifically anti-atherosclerotic. They don't have effects on blood pressure. They don't have effect on lipids. There are GLP-1 receptors in the heart, and
that is the point.
But I'm still suspect.
There are two other factors that you didn't take into account. Both of these classes are either weight neutral or weight losing, so that the weight itself may be having an effect, and neither class causes hypoglycemia to the degree of the older agents. So the elimination of the hypoglycemia and the elimination
of
weight gain.
Interesting discussion, but we need to move on with the program. So we were talking about head-to-head studies here at the meeting, and I'm interested to hear more about those head-to-head studies. I mean, you talk about the DPP-4. Were there any interesting head-to-head studies with the GLP-1 receptor analogs already approved in this conference?
Funny you should ask. The idea of doing head-to-head clearly is critically important for clinical decision-making. And what was reported by John Buse at this meeting was the Duration 6 study, which examined the randomization of individuals to the once-weekly formulation of exenatide versus the once-daily formulation of liraglutide. Now, this study was sponsored by Eli Lilly and Amylin Pharmaceuticals, who make the once weekly. And I think that that's an important issue when it comes to head-to-head studies. The study was designed to show non-inferiority between the two drugs. What that means is that the hemoglobin A1C changes at the end would fall within a 0.3% range. Turns out that this study did not meet the non-inferiority guidelines. And in fact, the once weekly formulation of exenatide lowered A1C by 1.28%, whereas the liraglutide once daily lowered it by 1.48%. So they failed their primary outcome variable. Now, the lira also appeared to have a bit greater weight loss effect, but it also had greater side effects with more nausea, more vomiting that was seen with the exenatide. So the difference in hemoglobin A1C is relatively narrow from a clinical standpoint, but in fact did not meet the non-inferiority criteria. And so now we begin to look at the comparative effectiveness of agents to try and personalize therapies for individuals.
Sure, but that's one of the points that Sylvia was making. In the decision-making process, it is not just the element of the A1C. You mentioned about the timing of the administration, the GI side effect profile, and so on. So how would you interpret this data, Sylvia?
So I'm not impressed by A1C differences in trials of anything less than 0.5% is, in my mind, ridiculous, pardon me. But remember, these are mean data that we're looking at. There are individual patients in these studies. And I think we need to look at what happens in an individual patient. And in my book, treating lots of patients with type 2 diabetes, what really drives my decision-making in medications is not solely the power of the drug to lower A1C, but how well it's going to be tolerated by the patient. A drug that lowers A1C by 4 percentage points but can't be taken by the patient because of side effects is not a good drug.
That's a good point. Let's examine some more new data. And Bob, you have published, and I was part of the study, and we published that data, the dose-ranging study of another GLP-1 receptor analog agonist, lixisenatide, which is once daily. And you show in this meeting a very interesting study in combination with sulfonylurea. But tell us a little bit about the dose-ranging study first, and then what you did in this study that you presented at this meeting.
The lixisenatide is an analog of exendin 4. It's really a GLP-1 receptor agonist, but it is not a GLP-1 receptor, a GLP-1 analog.
No, so it's an agonist.
It's a little bit different there. It's intermediate action. It's longer acting than exenatide. It's shorter acting than liraglutide. And what we did in the dose-ranging study was really to look at once daily, twice daily, through a large range of lixisenatide doses to come up with an optimal dose of 20 micrograms once daily. And that goes through a titration from 10 to 15 to 20 in general. But at this meeting, one study actually looked at randomization to a direct titration from 10 to 20, and it worked just as well and was tolerated well.
It worked as well as 20 BID, 20 once a day and 20 BID.
Well, that's the old study. The differences were not significant.
Correct.
Between BID and
No, that's
once
that's
daily.
The question I ask you. In the dose ranging, there was no difference between giving once a day or twice a day. You
Correct.
Get the same effect.
Correct. So now what we're beginning to see are the phase 3 trials with lixisenatide, most of which are being dictated by the regulatory agencies. So add on to metformin monotherapy, add on to metformin plus sulfonylurea, and then moving on forward. So we've looked at this in those individuals who have failed two oral agents, metformin and an SU. And in this circumstance, what we did was we left them on the SU as well and randomized to placebo. And what we found was that you could very effectively lower hemoglobin A1C with the addition of lixisenatide, so that we saw an additional 0.85% fall in hemoglobin A1C with the new agent on board. The other thing that we observed was, despite the addition of the sulfonylurea, we didn't see an increased risk of hypoglycemia, and we still got the weight loss of 1.76 kilos as compared to the placebo group who lost less than 1 kilo.
And the magnitude of the changes were pretty much similar to the old Amigos trial with exenatide, correct?
The changes are relatively consistent as you go through all of the different GLP-1 receptor agonist studies. But I think that ultimately what you're looking for there is the head-to-head studies, and we'll get to that in a bit.
Yeah, no, I know. But before we get to the head-to-head, so tell me, what do you think about the potential there of this compound? You told me that it has homology to exenatide. Exenatide is twice a day, and lixisenatide is once a day. Is that the only potential that they have? Is that the main differentiator?
Not really. Lixisenatide would be considered to still fall into the category of the shorter-acting GLP-1 receptor agonists that have a preferential effect on postprandial glucose excursion as compared to the longer-acting ones, which basically just lower the baseline that everything is acting on. The unique aspect of lixisenatide is that from a physical chemical standpoint, it's actually stable in combination with insulin glargine. So now the concept of co-formulation of glargine with lixisenatide as a single injectable really raises the possibility and the interesting aspect of the value of combination insulin and GLP-1.
Well, and actually it's good that you raised this point, but before that point, which is a good approach to put it in combination. But the proof of concept from some perspective is in the study that was recently published, and we had the opportunity to be part of that study, a study reported by John Buse, where we took people who were already on insulin glargine, people with type 2 diabetes for 12 years, difficult to control, A1Cs in the 8.3, 8.5% range, with 0.4, 0.5 units per kilo, pretty much what you see in the Yale Clinic in New Haven, and very difficult to control. So what we did with these patients where we entered into the study, they were randomized to add on exenatide, which has a good postprandial effect, or injections of placebo. But both groups had the insulin glargine optimized. They had already 0.5 units per kilo, but they're optimized. So the group that were on insulin glargine alone and had the insulin glargine optimized went from 8.5 to 7.4, which already got control, which tells a little bit about the clinical inertia or insulin titration inertia, that people don't titrate the insulin. But those who had the insulin titrated and had the exenatide went from 8.3 to 6.7. which is remarkable for somebody with 12 years of diabetes. And it's remarkable that despite giving more insulin, getting below 6.7%, they still lost around 1.5 kilos. And despite giving more insulin and getting down to 6.7, did not show a much increase a hypoglycemia risk. Would those results impress you, Dr. Inzuki?
Well, the alternative, obviously, in patients on a basal insulin who are not getting to target would be advancing their insulin therapy, not just with the basal, but also potentially with bolus injections. And that, as you know, particularly in older patients, those with cardiovascular disease, mm-hmm. becomes very complicated. And that intensive insulin therapy is fraught with the side effects of hypoglycemia and progressive weight gain.
Well, then the key issue, if we're going to use this thinking of glargine plus exenatide, and assuming that exenatide and lixisenatide look very similar, the question is, can we apply that concept for lixisenatide, which is what you mentioned? And we actually, in this meeting, we are presenting a study where we did head-to-head comparison of exenatide versus lixisenatide. And there was nothing surprising there. I mean, you would expect that both drugs, as you said, exenatide is twice daily, lixisenatide is once a day. Both the drugs actually had a similar effect in terms of the A1C reduction, around 0.9%, 0.8 to 0.9% approximately. They have weight loss. There was a little bit more weight loss with the exenatide, and was a little bit less GI side effects with lixisenatide. But the point is that in general, they were fairly similar. And the key issue is that what I like about these two options is that they have more significant postprandial effect, and so which makes a good combination with a basal insulin.
So again, we're coming to customizing therapy to meet the needs of the patient, so that if, in fact, fasting is your primary target, then the longer-acting formulations of GLP-1 receptor agonists would be the way to go, or basal insulin. The combination of basal insulin with a GLP-1 would suggest you're probably going to do better by adding in a shorter-acting GLP-1 receptor agonist.
Well, this is an interesting field. This is further after you have used oral agents and so on, and the decision about using a GLP-1 receptor analog as a first injectable or basal insulin, the first injectable there. But as we said initially, Sylvia, we need to intervene earlier. And when do you think that the incretin-related therapy, specifically GLP-1 receptor agonist, fit in the natural history of type 2 diabetes and the timing of intervention with these agents?
So I'm conflicted in this area because the physiology of the GLP-1 receptor agonist would suggest a beta cell effect, potentially, at least in animal models, enhancement of the durability of insulin secretion over time. We use the term beta cell protection. I'm not exactly sure any of us know exactly what that means, but there's an attractiveness to using drugs that might be beneficial for the beta cell earlier in the disease course. Of course, there are a lot of issues with using a GLP-1 receptor agonist as monotherapy. There are plenty of effective medications. Metformin is going to be hard to usurp as the foundation therapy in type 2 diabetes.
It's safe. As long as it's tolerated.
As long as it's tolerated, but it's safe, it's effective, it's very, very cost-effective. So there's an attractiveness to using some of these incretin-based therapies earlier on in the disease course, but we really always need to consider not only tolerability, but cost.
Yeah, and I think that the various and sundry practice guidelines that have been promulgated clearly recognize that metformin is the foundation therapy in those type 2s who can tolerate it. 15 to 20% actually come off of therapy either because they don't tolerate it or they have contraindications,
sure.
In particular renal disease. But assuming that you can tolerate metformin, both the ADA EASD guidelines and the ACE guidelines always begin with metformin. Now, the difference between those guidelines is really quite profound, that the ADA EASD guidelines went for simplicity with two tiers. The first tier are the drugs where we have long-term safety outcomes, and those are recommended purely for the long-term outcomes. Second tier, they suggest could be used, but with the precaution that there is less long-term outcome data available.
Sure.
But what they're doing is they're using mean data. They're really looking at hitting a target A1C, and they don't specify populations that might be able to get there. That's what the ACE guidelines have really tried to do. They start out with where is the patient's hemoglobin A1C to begin with. The difficulty with the ACE guidelines is they're incredibly complex. And for a busy private practitioner, it's going to be very difficult to keep the entire algorithm in mind and be able to track through it. But from a physiologic standpoint, the ACE guidelines begin to make a little bit more sense.
Very little more sense. So, as we wrap up our discussion, we'd like to know the answer to this polling question. This is an obese patient with type 2 diabetes who is on metformin and a sulfonylurea. His A1C is 8 to 8.5%. What would you choose as a next step? Basal insulin, a GLP-1 receptor agonist, or another medication? Well, we've come to the end of our very stimulating discussion. It's been very nice, very warm, very, very active discussion. I want to thank my good friend Sylvia Nzuki and Bob Radner. And I'd like to thank you for participating in this CME activity. To proceed to the online CME test, click on the Earn CME Credit link on this page. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this excerpt of the CME activity, Individualizing Treatment Targets and Choice of Medication in Type 2 Diabetes, Intercrine-Based Therapies. To participate in the CME activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title.